Woman of Vision, Chapter 38, the 1911 edition of The Great Controversy, Not a Revision. As C. H. Jones, manager of Pacific Press, was preparing in early January 1910 for the annual constituency meeting to be held later in the month, he took stock of the accomplishments in 1909, the work in hand, and some things to which attention needed to be given in 1910. On January 5th he wrote to his close friend and long associate in the work of the church, W. C. White, listing things he felt needed consideration. Among these, under the heading, Great Controversy English, he wrote, "It will be necessary to print another edition of this book on or before July, 1910. You are aware that the plates are worn out. New plates ought to be made before printing another edition." Ellen White owned the printing plates for her books. Whatever would be done with the Great Controversy would be done under her direction and at her expense. In these matters, W. C. White served as her business agent. The work that eventually was done in what has come to be known as the 1911 revision, a term too strong for what actually took place, was not contemplated in the initial plans. In other words, no need was seen for changes in the book at the time that plans were initiated for resetting the type, nor were any alterations in the G. White text contemplated, beyond technical corrections as might be suggested by Miss Mary Stewart, a proofreader of long experience and now a member of Ellen White's staff. Work on the book was undertaken in a routine fashion and according to plan. Miss Stewart reviewed the book, checking spelling, capitalization, punctuation, etc. She finished her work late in February. By mid-March, Pacific Press had copy for resetting the first five chapters and a portion of the sixth. In the meantime, as a corollary to resetting the Great Controversy, thoughts began to develop both in the minds of Ellen White and the members of her staff regarding certain features of the new reset book. These related not only to the physical features of the book typeface, illustrations, etc., but also to the text itself. Mrs. White wrote of this to F. M. Wilcox, chairman of the Review and Herald Board, "When I learned that the Great Controversy must be reset, I determined that we would have everything closely examined to see if the truths it contained were stated in the very best manner, to convince those not of our faith that the Lord had guided and sustained me in the writing of its pages." Letter 56, 1911. These and other considerations led W. C. White to reach out for helpful suggestions. He reported, "We took counsel with the men of the publishing department, with state canvassing agents, and with members of the publishing committees, not only in Washington, but in California, and I asked them to kindly call our attention to any passages that needed to be considered in connection with the resetting of the book." WCW 2. Our General Missionary Agents, July 24, 1911, see also selected messages 3:439-440. As suggestions began to come in, he called a halt to typesetting and the making of printing plates. At this point, 120 pages had been sent to the type foundry for plate making, and type had been set for 100 more pages. Considerations initiated by plans for a new edition, The Great Controversy, was Ellen White's most important book. She regarded it as a volume designed to win readers to an understanding and acceptance of the light of present truth. This lifted the matter of a new edition somewhat above the mechanical production of a volume for literature evangelists to introduce to the people of the world, to the excellence of the text itself, depicting the Great Controversy story in an accurate and winning way. So, relatively early in 1910, there loomed before Ellen White, her staff, and the publishers the task of perfecting the text to reflect a precision of expression and the employment of words acceptable to both Catholic and Protestant readers. The steps to accomplish this were grasped somewhat progressively. While Ellen White, with a full sense of this implication, carried the responsibility for many changes in the text, she delegated the details of the work to several members of her experienced and trusted office staff. But she held herself as the ultimate judge, and she would from time to time consider specific points and finally review the text of the manuscript. It should be stated here that neither Mrs. White nor her staff considered what was done as an actual revision, and all studiously avoided the use of the term, for it was entirely too broad in its connotation. It was agreed upon early that the new edition of the book should be held as nearly as possible, page for page, to the widely circulated 1888 printing. At the outset, work on the illustrations for the new book had been undertaken. This was a point of importance in a volume to be sold by Colporters. The typesetting that had begun was now being held in abeyance. W. C. White at first thought that the delay would be only a week or two, allowing, as he said in his letter to Jones on May 17, 1910, for careful study of suggestions recently received from brethren connected with the Review and Herald. White continued, "You may be sure we will do all we can to minimize the changes, not only in the pages molded and in the pages set, but in the whole book. We feel, however, that now is the time to give faithful consideration to the suggestions that have been made to us. Finding sources for the quotations, the most demanding of the tasks connected with readying the book for resetting was the tracking down of all quotations employed in the book 417 in all, drawn from 75 authors, 10 periodicals, and 3 encyclopedias. It was while Ellen White was in Europe and had access to the library left by J. N. Andrews at the denomination's publishing house in Basel, Switzerland, that the manuscript for the 1888 edition was largely prepared. At Elmshaven, Clarence Chrysler was now in charge of seeking out the sources and verifying the quotations. Progress report to Elder Daniels in a letter to A. G. Daniels written on June 20, 1910. W. C. White reported, "During the last 2 weeks, we have been busily engaged in studying those matters which demanded consideration in connection with the bringing out of the new edition of Great Controversy. When I presented to Mother questions as to what we should do regarding the quotations from historians and the references to these historians, she was prompt and clear in her opinion that we ought to give proper credit wherever we can. This has called for a good deal of searching of histories. Brethren Chrysler and D. E. Robinson have taken much pains to look up the very best English authorities for the bulls and decrees and letters quoted and referred to, and they have been successful beyond my fondest hopes." Then White wrote of the involvements in the preparation of the new edition of the book. Further than this, there will be very few changes made. In a few places where ambiguous or misleading terms have been used, Mother has authorized a changed reading, but she protests against any change in the argument or subject matter of the book, and indeed, we find, as we study into the matter, a clear and satisfactory defense for those passages to which our critics might take exception. There are a few historical matters which we are still searching for. The most perplexing one is that regarding the 3.5 days when the dead bodies of the two witnesses lay unburied, as referred to in Revelation 11 verses 9 to 11, DF 836. E. G. White settles the question of the Daubeen quotations. 10 days after this report was made by W. C. White to A. G. Daniels, a question arose, sparked by the checking of all quoted materials in the book. It was found that the most frequently quoted historian was Daubeen, whose History of the Reformation, written in French, had been published in 5 translations in England and the United States. 3 of the translations were represented in the Great Controversy, but it was discovered that only one had the wholehearted approval of the author. The question now was, should all the matter quoted from this author be from just the one that had the author's approval? To do so would call for a good many changes in the Great Controversy text, and in some cases, provide a less desirable wording. Work on the pages involved was held up until this matter could be settled by Ellen White herself. In the meantime, possibly with some intimation of the question that had to be settled, Mrs. White made a clear-cut statement to Mary Stewart that Mary carefully wrote out, dated, and signed on July 31st. "Here it is. Whenever any of my workers find quotations in my writings, I want those quotations to be exactly like the book they are taken from. Sometimes they have thought they might change a few words to make it a little better, but it must not be done. It is not fair. When we quote a thing, we must put it just as it is, DF 83b. To make any alterations in the text of the book written under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, especially a book as widely circulated and studiously read as The Great Controversy, was recognized by Ellen White and the staff at Elmshaven as something that would raise questions in the minds of Seventh-day Adventists. Many were jealous for Ellen White and the Spirit of Prophecy, and not having thought the matter through, held, for all practical purposes, to a theory of verbal inspiration in the work of God's prophets. An action disavowing this stance was taken by the General Conference in session in 1883, but by 1911 this was either unknown or forgotten by Adventists generally. Here is the wording. We believe the light given by God to his servants is by the enlightenment of the mind, thus imparting the thoughts, and not, except in rare cases, the very words in which the ideas should be expressed. The Review and Herald, November 27, 1883, in MR, page 65, and selected messages 3 hours 96 minutes, and W. C. White, in the 1911 statement, approved fully by his mother, addressed himself specifically to the matter of verbal inspiration. He pointed out, "Mother has never laid claim to verbal inspiration, and I do not find that my father, or elders Bates, Andrews, Smith, or Wagoner, put forth this claim. If there were verbal inspiration in writing her manuscripts, why should there be on her part the work of addition or adaptation? It is a fact that Mother often takes one of her manuscripts and goes over it thoughtfully, making additions that develop the thought still further." WCW Letter, July 24, 1911, see also Ibid, 3:437. Clarence Chrysler's Testimony. In January 1911, Clarence Chrysler wrote to Guy Dale in Europe offering his testimony regarding what he saw of God's guiding hand in the writing of the Great Controversy. The more closely we examine the use of historical extracts in controversy, and the historical extracts themselves, the more profoundly are we impressed with the fact that Sister White had special guidance in tracing the story from the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, down through the centuries until the end. No mortal could have done the work that she has done in shaping up some of those chapters, including, we believe, the chapter on the French Revolution, which is a very remarkable chapter, in more ways than one. And the more we go into these matters, the more profound is our conviction that the Lord has helped not only Sister White in the presentation of truth, but that He has overruled in the work of other writers, to the praise of His name and the advancement of present truth. Our brethren in years past have used many quotations, and, as a general rule, the Lord surely must have helped them to avoid making use of many extracts that would have led them astray. Of course, there is still a great deal of room for improvement, even in a book like Elder U. Smith's Daniel and Revelation. But not so much needs to be done, as might have had to be done, if the Lord had not given special help to these various writers. DF 84D, CCC to Guy Dale, January 3, 1911. A review of what was done to the book with the new printing of The Great Controversy now on the market. It was important to take particular note of exactly what was done in preparing the copy for resetting the type for the 1911 edition. W. C. White was in charge of the work at Elmshaven. He was the principal spokesman during the period of work on the book, and quite naturally was the one to make explanations that might be called for. On July 24, 1911, a few days after receiving a copy of the new book, he wrote a letter addressed to publishing house managers, which he repeated the next day in a letter to our general missionary agents, publishing department leaders. This he later included in a statement read to the General Conference Committee in its autumn council held in Washington, D.C. These W. C. White letters of explanation, quoted from in this chapter, carried Ellen White's written approval. Because of limitations in space, only excerpts can be included in this chapter. The reader is urged to pursue them in full in Appendix A of Selected Messages, Book 3. After mentioning that the new book runs page for page, he introduced the principal features. The most noticeable change in the new edition is the improvement in the illustrations. Each of the 42 chapters, together with the preface, introduction, contents, and list of illustrations, has a beautiful pictorial heading, and 10 new full-page illustrations have been introduced, to take the place of those which were least attractive. The 13 appendix notes of the old edition, occupying 13 pages, have been replaced by 31 notes, occupying 12 pages. These are nearly all reference notes, intended to help the studious reader in finding historical proofs of the statements made in the book. In the body of the book, the most noticeable improvement is the introduction of historical references. In the old edition, over 700 biblical references were given, but in only a few instances were there any historical references to the authorities quoted or referred to. In the new edition, the reader will find more than 400 references to 88 authors and authorities. WCW Letter, July 24, 1911, see also Ibid, 3:434. E. G. White reads and approves changes from time to time as the work of the Great Controversy progressed. Important matters were taken to Ellen White for decision, and the staff at Elmshaven worked under general instructions from her. Finally, When the type was set and proof sheets were available from the publishers, a set was marked showing clearly both the old reading and the new, and these were submitted to her for careful reading and approval. An envelope in the White Estate document file number 85 E carries the notation. Controversy proofs prepared for Mrs. E. G. White's inspection and approval. All approved. At last the work was done, a work much more demanding than was anticipated when those involved began in January 1910. By early July 1911 the book was in the binderies of Pacific Press and the Review and Herald. On Monday, July 17th, copies of the newly published The Great Controversy, the 1911 edition, were received at Elmshaven. It was a joyous day. Time running out. Important councils. Writing and book preparation occupied most of Ellen White's time during the last years of her life. She worked with a sense of time running out. But as in earlier years, her ministry was somewhat mixed. From time to time writing was laid aside for important interviews, occasional appointments in nearby churches, trips to Loma Linda, and camp meetings. Book preparation, the Acts of the Apostles. When the staff at Elmshaven late in 1910 learned that the Sabbath school lessons for 1911 were to be on the early Christian church, it was contemplated that materials on New Testament history, released week by week in Review and Herald articles, would serve as lesson helps. Then the plan was that Clarence Chrysler, as soon as the work on the Great Controversy was completed, would assemble materials on the life of Paul. He would take the 1883 G. White book sketches from the life of Paul as the foundation of this work. This book had been long out of print. Mrs. White had been looking forward to the time when she could expand its presentation. Now Chrysler would draw from this as well as from other E. G. White sources of the past 25 or more years. Because Maggie Hare, now Mrs. Bree, hard at work on the experiences of the early Christian church, became ill, the work was delayed. The deadline for copy for the January 5th issue of the Review, the time when the new series was to begin, was missed. WCW to F. M. Wilcox, January 17, 1911. But 4 weeks later the Review and Herald carried two articles in time to parallel current Sabbath school lessons. Ellen White was much involved in the task, going over the materials as they were assembled, doing some editing and writing to fill in gaps. All of this was done with an eye on the full manuscript for the forthcoming book to be known as the Acts of the Apostles. On October 6, 1911, she wrote, "I feel more thankful than I can express for the interest my workers have taken in the preparation of this book, that its truths might be presented in the clear and simple language which the Lord has charged me never to depart from in any of my writings." Letter 80, 1911. The Acts of the Apostles was off the press and ready for sale in late November. It was with satisfaction that Ellen White's staff noted her ability to engage actively in the preparation of book manuscripts at this late period in her life. Prophets and Kings. When the year 1912 dawned, Ellen White was in her 85th year. Acquaintances, church leaders, and her family marveled at her continued ability to produce. In early January she wrote, "There will be one more book that dealing with the Old Testament history from the time of David to the time of Christ, Prophets and Kings. The material for this book has been written, and is on file, but is not yet put into shape. When this book is complete, I shall feel that my work is finished. Yet I can hold my pen as firmly today as I have done in years past." Letter 4, 1912. Back in 1907, Clarence Chrysler had assembled Ellen White's writings on Ezra for a series of review articles. The Sabbath school lessons for the first quarter of 1907 were on the Book of Ezra, and it was hoped these articles would provide collateral reading. The task was larger than expected, and while the preliminary material on Nehemiah was printed in the Review in March and April, it was not until January and February 1908 that the five articles on Ezra were published. But the 18 articles on this phase of Old Testament history were steps in the preparation of Prophets and Kings. The main thrust in preparing Prophets and Kings, however, was in the late summer months and fall of 1912. Ellen White wrote, "Just now, what strength I have is given mostly to bringing out in book form what I have written in past years on the Old Testament history from the time of Solomon to the time of Christ. Last year the Acts of the Apostles was put into print, and is being widely circulated, and now we are making good progress with this Old Testament history. We are advancing as fast as possible. I have faithful and conscientious helpers, who are gathering together what I have written for the Review, Signs, and Watchmen, and in manuscripts and letters, and arranging it in chapters for the book. Sometimes I examine several chapters in a day, and at other times I can read but little because my eyes become weary and I am dizzy. The chapters that I have been reading recently are very precious. Letter 20, 1912. There had been a hastening of the work on Old Testament history, with the determination to bring it to completion while Ellen White could be involved. Now the task was well along, and Clarence Chrysler went back to some of the chapters that in richness came short of most of the manuscript. With Ellen White's counsel and help, he was rounding them out. This is why the manuscript, which earlier had been spoken of as almost completed, was still in preparation, wrote Chrysler on New Year's Day 1915. As we find new material from the file and add to the chapters that have already been prepared and passed upon, and reread these amplified portions to her, she seems to enjoy going over them anew. This perfecting of the manuscript is slow work, but very interesting, and we are hopeful of the outcome. CCC to WCW, January 1, 1915. This manuscript, published under the title of The Captivity and Restoration of Israel, had not been completed at the time of Ellen White's death, but was completed by Clarence Chrysler from materials in the manuscript file. Later it was published as Prophets and Kings. Other books that were being compiled from file material in much the same way but which were completed later were Gospel Workers, Education, The Ministry of Healing, and Life Sketches of Ellen G. White. Ellen White's last trips to Loma Linda on Thursday, March 30, 1911, Ellen White broke away from the work at Elmshaven, taking with her Helen Graham, one of the secretaries, and Sarah McKenterfer, her traveling companion and nurse. She set out for Loma Linda, where important meetings of the board were to be held early in April. There were 76 acres, 31 hectares, of land in the 1905 purchase of the Loma Linda property, 23, 9 hectares, in the hill site and the remaining 53, 21 hectares, in a strip of fertile valley land extending 3/5 of a mile, 1 kilometer, toward the railway. The hill land was half occupied by buildings, lawns, drives, etc. The other half was orchard. Of the valley land, a portion provided a site for barns, stables, vegetable garden, and 3 acres of apricot trees. The balance was in alfalfa, and there was land suitable for grain. Pressed as they were for money to meet the $40,000 purchase price, some looked hopefully to the sale of the valley land as building sites. When Ellen White heard of this, she urged that no land be sold. None was sold. J. A. Burden and others associated with him felt there was a need of acquiring even more land for the institution. Within a few months, a 30-acre, 12-hectare, site just east was offered for something less than $100 an acre, and it was secured. Shortly after this, Ellen White asked to see this land and was taken to the top of the sanitarium building where she could view it. G. A. Owen, board chairman, reported that she scanned it carefully for a time, and then remarked, "Well, we are thankful we have it." Special Testimonies, Series B17A2. Then she turned and looked to the north, to the land in the front of the sanitarium that stretched to the railroad and Colton Avenue beyond. She waved her hand and declared, "The angel said, get all of it." Somewhat startled, those with her reminded her of the financial difficulties experienced in securing what land they had, and she responded, "Well, we shall be thankful for what we have," and turned and went to her room. The brethren pondered just what was included in the words of the angel, "Get all of it." The land north of the institution was in several tracts. One, of 150 acres, 61 hectares, was held at $18,000. Another, of 55 acres, 22 hectares, was held for $20,000. Another 27 acres, 11 hectares, could be had for $2,250. And still another 20 acres, 8 hectares, just north of the railway was available for $750. But who had the foresight, and where would the money come from? Nothing was done, and 3 years went by. But in those 3 years some of the tracts were sold, and what was left doubled in price. When the decision to develop a medical school at Loma Linda was reached in 1910, the pattern of thinking began to change. In May, at the time of the organization meeting held at Loma Linda, at which Ellen White was present, steps were taken to secure land just in front of the institution. It was purchased for about $600 an acre, on hand for the 1911 constituency meeting. Now it was April 1911, and Ellen White was at Loma Linda again. Her intense interest in the developments there led her for a year or two to go south to be present when the major board meetings were held in the spring and fall. Her counsel was much treasured by those who moved ahead, eager to see that the work was done in harmony with the mind of God as revealed through His messenger. The 1911 constituency meeting was held during the first week of April. The record reveals that, among other things, study was given to the importance of securing more land adjacent to the institution. A number looked over the Kelly tract of about 85 acres, 34 hectares, available at $300 an acre, but no action was taken to purchase it. Immediately following the meetings of the constituency and the board, Ellen White went on south to spend a few days at Paradise Valley Sanitarium. But 10 days later she was back at Loma Linda, saying that her work there was not finished. The matter of securing more land rested heavily on her heart, and she talked of it and took several trips by carriage to look things over again. Repeatedly she stated that she had been instructed that the denomination should secure the land adjoining the sanitarium, and she urged that the brethren pray over the matter so that they might have light to know what to do. She mentioned the troubles that would come if others were allowed to secure the land and sell it to unbelievers. Her rather relentless pressing of the matter led Elder Burton to call a council meeting of available workers on Thursday, April 20th, to consider what should be done in the light of the availability of the Kelly Tract. Ellen White was the principal speaker. After a few opening remarks she came right to the point. "Today with Sister McKentifer, and again with my son, I rode around the Loma Linda grounds, and took more particular notice of them than ever before, and I feel very thankful that we have such a place. In our meetings during this council, we have been speaking of the higher education. What is the higher education? It is to understand Christ's works and teachings, and to follow on to know the Lord. It is to know that His going forth is prepared as the morning. Today, as I looked over the place more thoroughly than ever before, I felt gratitude in my heart toward God, that through His providence we had been brought into possession of Loma Linda. I felt thankful also to see the improvements that have been made since we have had the place. And I thought how important it is that we make every move in accordance with the will of God. As the Lord prospers us, we should manifest our gratitude by a willingness to advance. We should see the advantage of adding to that which we already have. I feel a burden regarding the danger of letting anybody come into the neighborhood to spoil the place. There is a piece of land across the railroad, lying next to a piece already purchased, which should be secured. I am sure, from the representations that have been made to me, that this piece of land ought to come into our possession. If you are wise, the next time I come here you will have that land. I will try to help you all I can. Let us work intelligently." She pledged $1,000 toward the purchase of the tract. Then she assured her audience that she was well pleased with what had been accomplished at Loma Linda. "When one sees the prosperity that has attended the work," she said, "and the spirit of consecration that prevails, the conviction deepens that you are working in harmony with God." In closing her remarks, she added, "I am highly gratified as I look upon the land we already have. This will be one of the greatest blessings to us in the future, one that we do not fully appreciate now, but which we shall appreciate by and by. I hope that you will get the other land that I have spoken of and join it to that which you already have. It will pay you to do this." Manuscript 9, 1911. She made this interesting prediction: "The Loma Linda Institution, if conducted according to the will of God, will become the most important in its work of all our institutions throughout the world." WCW to AGED, June 16, 1912. In the development of the medical school, the point had been reached where provision had to be made for the clinical years of physician training. At first it was hoped that these needs could largely be met with the construction of a modest hospital at Loma Linda. Now it was clear that with the relatively sparse population in the area, the hospital at Loma Linda would be inadequate. They had to look to a populated area. As the Loma Linda board wrestled with the problem, they were well aware of Ellen White's repeated advice that a sanitarium should not be located in Los Angeles. She was drawn in for counsel, and met with the board on the afternoon of April 4th. W.C. White had discussed the matter of the clinical needs with his mother, as they drove together that morning about the Loma Linda grounds. It now seemed overwhelmingly evident that the clinical work needed to be done largely in a center of population, and the question had narrowed down to a choice of going into Los Angeles for all of the clinical work, or of doing part of the work at Loma Linda and part in Los Angeles. Ellen White spoke up cheerfully and promptly, and said that that was the better way to do part of the work in Loma Linda, and part in Los Angeles. Both in the conversation with her son and now with the board, she supported this proposition, Manuscript 14, 1912. After spending another week or two at Loma Linda, she returned to Elmshaven, where it was back to the work of reading manuscripts, writing, and occasionally filling speaking appointments. After the month-long stay in Southern California, Ellen White found living and working conditions at Elmshaven more comfortable than they had been in former winters. A new steam central heating plant had been installed, with a large wood-burning furnace in the basement of a nearby tank house. While fireplaces would continue to enhance the attractiveness of the home, they would not be used exclusively to heat the large rooms with their high ceilings. And in the office, steam radiators also took the place of the messy little wood stoves. The visit of bookmen. On Thursday, January 23, 1913, the staff at Elmshaven, except for W. C. White, who was in the East, played host to a group of about 40 men and women who arrived at the home about 4 p.m. For several days, the literature evangelists working in the five union conferences in the territory of Pacific Press had been in Mountain View, together with conference leaders and others, for a convention. Now callporters, some of their wives, church leaders, and some others were spending the day visiting Pacific Union College, St. Helena Sanitarium, and Elmshaven. Advance notice had been given and preparations were made to receive them. Appropriate exhibits showing books, documents, manuscripts, and letters that would be of interest to visitors were set up in the library room next to the manuscript vault. As they crowded into Ellen White's living room and dining room, she came down to receive them and to read her message of greeting. It said, in part, "I welcome you all to Elmshaven, the refuge that I found prepared for me on my return from Australia. In this quiet and comfortable home, we have been able to prepare articles and books for publication. I hope you will enjoy your visit, and that you may come again. In your prosperity and welfare, I am deeply interested. All who consecrate themselves to God to work as canvassers are assisting to give the last message of warning to the world. They are the Lord's messengers, giving to multitudes in darkness and error the glad tidings of salvation." Letter 3, 1913. After recounting some experiences in which Seventh-day Adventists were led to gain a broader grasp of the task before them, she urged her guests to pray for a deeper experience, and urged also that they go forth with hearts filled with the precious truths that God had given His people for this time. After addressing them for about 30 minutes, she presented each with one of her books of their choice, The Desire of Ages, The Acts of the Apostles, or some other. The gift was made doubly memorable by a card in each book bearing a printed message of good cheer and her signature. The General Conference Session of 1913. The 38th session of the General Conference was scheduled to be held in Washington, D.C. from May 15 to June 8, 1913. As with the 1909 session held 4 years before, meetings would be in a large tent pitched on the grounds of Washington Missionary College in Tacoma Park, Maryland. The expectation was that Ellen G. White, now 85 years of age, would not attempt to attend. In early May, she made her final decision, writing to Edson on the 7th. "I shall not attend. I desire to save my strength for the work here that is essential to be done." Letter 9, 1913. W. C. White wrote that she was quite content with the decision. WCW to AGED, May 1, 1913. She did, however, prepare two messages to be read to the session and sent them with her son. On the first Sabbath afternoon of the session, W. C. White was called upon to read Ellen White's message of greeting to the delegates. It contained a challenge to face the work with hopefulness and courage and venture to undertake by faith the work called for, a work they could not fully understand. As they went forward in the fear of God, they would receive rich blessing. She was referring to evangelizing the cities. Ellen White had a continuing burden for the cities. In September 1909, Testimonies for the Church, Volume 9, carried a section titled, "The Work in the Cities," with a strong appeal to ministers and laymen. "Behold the cities," she urged, "and their need of the gospel." Page 97. She told of how the need of earnest laborers among the multitudes of the cities had been kept before her for more than 20 years. Ibid. The General Conference Bulletin reported the response to Ellen White's message. The reading of this letter brought forth many hearty amens from the brethren on the rostrum and throughout the congregation. T. Tears flowed freely as Sister White's expressions of confidence in her brethren and in God's leadership of his people were read. The General Conference Bulletin, 1913-32. Courage in the Lord. The President of the General Conference, A. G. Daniels, presented Ellen White's second message to the delegates 10 days later at the business session on Tuesday morning, May 27. It opened, "Recently in the night season, my mind was impressed by the Holy Spirit with the thought that if the Lord is coming as soon as we believe he is, we ought to be even more active than we have been in years past." Ibid. 164. Later in the message he declared, "I long to be personally engaged in earnest work in the field, and I should most assuredly be engaged in more public labor did I not believe that at my age it is not wise to presume on one's physical strength." Ibid. There was one part of her message to the session that touched a chord in the hearts of many of the delegates present, such as J. N. Loughborough, who with Ellen White had attended the very first session of the General Conference held in Battle Creek in May, 1863, exactly 50 years before, and G. I. Butler, an associate for many years. Here are her comforting and encouraging words. "I greatly desire that the old soldiers of the cross, those grown gray in the Master's service, shall continue to bear their testimony right to the point, in order that those younger in the faith may understand that the messages which the Lord gave us in the past are very important at this stage of the earth's history." Ibid. There was no word of pessimism in Ellen White's farewell message to the leaders of the church and assembly.